Well, again, this is Casey Trufo, and I just want to welcome you to day 5 of the Therapist Leadership Conference. And we have Dr. Jeff Zeig in just a moment that's going to be speaking with us. Jeff, we've just got about 5 more minutes as people are joining us on the line that we're just kind of welcoming them.
Okay.
And so you are a master of conferences, so the fact that you honored me by attending this one, I'm just incredibly grateful.
Well, you honor us by speaking at ours.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you. And I have my flyer here for the Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference, and I want to make sure that partway through, perhaps about halfway through, we talk a little bit about this. Would you be okay with that?
Oh, 100%. Thank you so much for doing that.
Okay. No, it's by far the best conference on the entire planet. And in fact, Time Magazine says it's the largest gathering ever devoted to the practice of psychotherapy. But it's more than that. It's the quality of the speakers. And I've been attending since I was a student and just absolutely every year love them and know more and learn more. And from the bottom of my heart, Jeff, I want to thank you for putting this on every so many years. You usually do it 5, but this time it's 4?
Yeah, it was a quirk. We couldn't find the proper venue in 2010 for the week that we wanted, and there's only a few cities in the United States where you can hold the conference. So Anaheim made us a deal for bringing the conference in 2009, and that's just how it happened. We really wanted to do it in 2010, but Orlando and New Orleans, Las Vegas, the venues that we wanted just weren't available.
Really? Mm-hmm. I'm very lucky because Anaheim is about 4 miles from where we are.
Uh-huh.
So we're really looking forward to it.
Oh, great. You're registered.
Are you kidding? I have everybody I know registering.
Oh, fantastic.
So, and again, there are some special discounts if you register at certain times. I don't know if we still have time for any of those.
Oh, yeah. There's the next early registration deadline is June 15th. Actually, we've extended it from May 31st to June 15th, and it's, we can even provide your listeners with a special discount code that would give them even a nicer discount.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I will look forward to that, and I'm sure lots of people will. Whenever I speak about conferences, Jeff, I start with the Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference. There's no other conference like it. And again, at about the half-hour mark, that's usually when most people are on the line.
Okay.
And so I want to make sure that we mention it then.
Sure.
Great. And I'm just curious, when you travel 18 days out of the country, how does that impact you physically? I'm just curious.
Well, I've been doing it for so long that I don't know any other way. So, of course, you know, you have to spend time resting, and the older that you get, the more recovery time that you need. But I'm leaving in the middle, I'm leaving on May 10th, and I'll be 18 days in Europe. So
wow.
I was 18 days in Asia. I'm here until May 10th, and then 18 days in, with the couples conference in between, we'll be in San Diego for the couples conference, which is May 1st through 4th, the third, 2nd and 3rd.
Yes, that's another one. If you haven't registered for that, are there still openings?
Yes.
So it's for the couples conference, and the website for that is, Jeff?
www.couplesconference.com.
Nice when we can get domain names that match exactly what our conference is.
Yeah.
www.couplesconference.com. It's in San Diego, May 1st through the 3rd. And at that conference, if you're interested in working with couples, you will have the premier faculty there. Everyone that's working with couples is there, and you will get so much out of it, so many techniques, theories, ideas.
Well, you have John Gottman, you have Chloe Madonis, Esther Perel, Ellen Bader, Pat Love, Terry Rial, Janice Spring. It's quite an event.
Absolutely, and we were lucky enough to have several of those presenters here at this conference, and they're asking for more. So make sure you head out to the Couples Conference, May 1st through the 3rd in San Diego, www.couplesconference.com. Okay, well, I can see we're right at the time, and I want to respect your time and everyone else's. So I think everybody knows who you are, but in case they don't, as I mentioned, you are the architect of the Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference, and that is absolutely probably the most important conference in the history of psychotherapy. You also organized the Brief Therapy Conference, the Couples Therapy Conference, the International Congress on Ericksonian Approaches to Hypnosis and Psychotherapy. You're on the editorial board of numerous journals. You're an approved supervisor, and you're also in private practice. I do not know how you do all of this.
I have a wonderful team that supports me.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to go ahead and mute our lines. Again, if you're on the telecast and you have questions for Dr. Zeig, as soon as they come in, please mention or start typing your question. And then, Jeff, they're saying they can't hear you very well. Is there a way you could put the microphone a little closer to your mouth?
Sure. Tell me if that works better. And if not, I'll just change telephones.
Okay, that's sounding better to me. Please let me know on the telecast if that's sounding better to you. Okay. So we're here with you, and you're going to share with us some things about Ericksonian hypnosis and about brief therapy. So experiential approaches to brief therapy lessons from Ericksonian hypnosis. And we've had the opportunity to hear a little bit from Bill O'Hanlon and Michael Yopko and some of the others talking about their experiences with Milton Erickson, and yet you know, probably know more, much more than all of them. So we're really looking forward to this. So I turn it over to you.
Okay, great. Well, I don't even cast Milton Erickson anymore as a hypnotist. I think that that wouldn't be to his liking, because Erickson certainly loved hypnosis, and he was certainly the person who dominated the field of hypnosis in the 20th century. But rather than casting Erickson as a hypnotist, I cast Erickson as the premier experiential psychotherapist, where we can conceptualize that a problem in psychotherapy is that people know, that is, they have information in their left hemisphere, but they don't necessarily realize what they know. And a problem for psychotherapists is, how do we help people? How do we empower the message so that people can realize what they know? And so then I cast hypnosis as just being one of a number of experiential techniques. A difficulty with that is that, having practiced hypnosis for 35 years, my perception is contaminated by hypnosis, and my way of approaching problems and my way of seeing problems has been contaminated, in the best sense of the word, by my understanding of hypnosis. And one of the understandings of hypnosis is the concept of states. And when I think of states, and when I write about states now, I often put states in quotation marks. This is a little bit of a throwback to T.X. Barber, one of the 20th century leading theorists about hypnosis. And he wrote hypnosis in parentheses, mainly because he was a behaviorist and didn't want to dignify hypnosis by considering it something that was in the purview of behavioral psychology. So he took some of the luster off of hypnosis by putting it in quotation marks and tried to make a point about the behavioral aspects of trance and that it could be divided into behavioral components. But what I do is to put the idea of states in quotation marks. So when we think about it, and patients come to us, one of the things that they're interested in is changing their state. Well, they want to be happier, or they want to be motivated, or they want to be more effective, or they want to stop procrastinating. But basically what they're asking for is a change in their state, and they're not asking for information. Actually, Frieda Fromm Reichman, the great psychoanalyst, said patients come to psychotherapy for an experience, not for information. And that's a psychoanalyst. And if you even think about Freudian therapy and you go back in time, we could probably cast Sigmund Freud as the quintessential experiential psychotherapist, because he made psychotherapy into something very weird. Imagine being in the Victorian era and going into a doctor's office. The doctor sits behind you. You lie down on a couch and you dump the contents of your consciousness as you're looking at the ceiling. Now, that is a remarkably weird experience. And the fact of the matter is that by having that experience, underlying experience, people changed. They got better. Now, when that experience has become more mainline, it doesn't have the same impact. And so one of our problems is how to help people to change states. And to me, the royal road, the bridge between the land of knowing and the land of realizing, is best bridged by the experiences that people have. So in doing psychotherapy, I tend to be very active, and very active even from the beginning of the session. So that the patient comes to me, say the patient has a garden variety depression. As the patient explains to me, I'm depressed, I know they want to change their state. One of the things I might do is to say, okay, where is it in your body that you most localize depression? And I get the person to start to experience where they might localize it in their body, describe some of the qualities of that experience in their body, and then I'd stand up from my chair and I'd say, okay, gently and respectfully, hand that depression to me. Take it out of your body, give it to me. I'm going to put it into my body in the same place that you have had it in your body, because I really want to know what it's like to be in that place. And then I'd like you to sit in your chair, and I'd like you to sculpt me into a representation of what your depression has been, so that you could see me sculpt myself into that vision, a sculpture of your depression. And then once I get out of the chair, and at that point, when the person sculpts me, I could be in a terribly unusual posture. I could be lying on the floor. I could be in the corner of the room, huddled up. And I will really move into some very strange and unique places. And then I will try to describe, for example, and this is just one example of an experiential assessment, I'll try to describe to the patient what my reality is, projecting what my reality is in their quote-unquote depressed state. And this to me would be homage to Carl Rogers. My original career started as a Rogerian therapist, and I thought that I would be a Rogerian therapist for my life because I was so wedded to that model. But this would be like a three-dimensional empathy. It would be more than just empathizing with a depressed person by saying, you seem a little down. I would be empathizing visually, and I would be empathizing with a sculpture, and I would be empathizing by suggesting the components of my own lived experience when I moved into their state. Now, part of the reason for this is that, for a moment into a polemic, that polemic would be that therapists terribly underfunction. And we underfunction because we don't really understand how we can use our medium to the maximum extent, and we're not trained to think about exploring how the outer reaches of our medium. Now, if you think about art, music, artists know to explore the edges of their medium, use new materials, find new ways of making compositions. And each artist will have their own unique perspective about how to explore the outer reaches of their medium. If, for example, Roy Lichtenstein does comic exaggeration, he's exploring a medium. If Seurat uses pointillism and his techniques of understanding how to put together colors, he's using a medium, and he's exploring the outer edges of a medium. He's exploring something that Monet hadn't explored. He's exploring something that Rembrandt hadn't explored. He's exploring the outer recesses of his medium. And unfortunately, as psychotherapists, we don't tend to do that. And even a simple thing like making a problem come visually alive, in the realm of Michael White talking about externalizing a problem, rather than saying, Mr. Alcohol has attacked this family and let's all huddle together and think about how to create a new narrative about how to deal with Mr. Alcohol, I will try to become visually alive, make the therapy appeal to the person's eyes. And when the person looks across the room and sees me huddled in a corner acting out their depression, partly this becomes a little computer virus. It's something that they can't escape from. And as a computer virus, I'm trying to contaminate and alter the unique program that is in the understructure of their problem state. And so I forgot to realize that I had a second line in this.
No worry, that happens to a lot of the speakers, so no worry.
Yeah. So then the essence of that is, how can we appeal to somebody's eyes? If somebody has 150 IQ, their verbal recall is extraordinary, and you can give them concepts and they'll deal with those concepts. If somebody has a 90 IQ, their verbal recall is not going to be that good, not compared to 150 IQ. But visual recognition is practically independent of IQ. So if you show people a series of pictures, and then you come back later and you say, which pictures did you see? Somebody with a 90 IQ is going to perform almost as well as somebody with 150 IQ. Visual recognition uses a different part of the brain. So if we want to do something simple to explore the outer edges of our medium, appeal to the person's eyes, and do something that makes the therapy come visually alive. Now, the second part of that is I wouldn't just sculpt a problem, I might sculpt a solution. So I might say to the person, what's the state that you want to be in? And then create a sculpture of that state. And then I might ask the person to look at that, take a picture of that in their mind's eye, close their eyes, and then I might move into a kind of hypnotic cadence, probably without the necessity of a formal induction, but perhaps at the moment with a formal induction, in which I would help that person to interiorize a new state. Now that's somewhat strange to psychotherapists because we don't think that we have a technology for helping people change states. But in hypnosis we learn you can say words that really impact physiology in profound ways. In hypnosis we learn we can do things that really change people's state and move them into a different quote-unquote state. And so my thinking about hypnosis is essential to my practice of psychotherapy. I don't do formal hypnosis all the time, but I would say 100% of the time, I'm thinking in terms of hypnosis as a way of creating powerful impact. The way that I learn to sequence things is studied from hypnosis. The ways that I learn to use my body sequenced from hypnosis, the ways that I might use the cadence of my voice, the direction of my voice, the tone of my voice. And so hypnosis has helped me to explore what are we capable of doing with human communication? How can we build responsiveness in ways that we haven't really realized before? And I suppose that a postscript to this particular part of the lecture would be that in some ways Freud was essentially wrong, that it's not about the unconscious per se, but it's about unconscious responsiveness. It's about how people respond in a social setting, the frame for our social setting, clinical work, psychotherapy, but how people respond to the demand characteristics, the nuances, the attributions that exist in that situation. Those are things that probably a researcher would call non-specific factors, but those are probably the things that make the difference that makes a difference in psychotherapy. And through studying hypnosis and through studying the work of Milton Erickson, I have learned more about how to build this implicit responsiveness. Now, that may take it one step further, that may sound strange to people to think about implicit responsiveness, except the whole field of social psychology, that's based on implicit responsiveness, how people respond without realizing what the stimulus was that caused the response. But also, when you think about art, architecture, you think about dance, music, movies, especially movies, there are so many implicit codes in movies to which we respond, but we don't even understand that we're responding to those codes. For example, a code in a movie would be that the protagonist, the hero, will come in from the left side of the screen, whereas the villain will come in from the right side of the screen. We are used to attributing things that come in from the right to the left with more tension, and we're used to attributing things that move from the left to the right with a more pleasing sense. Now, movie makers understand this code, they use this code, they know that people respond implicitly to this code, but it's not public knowledge, and even some movie makers who I've talked to don't necessarily understand that code, but they use it implicitly. And we respond without realizing what it is that has led to our response, what has caused an emotional impact. So the latest edge to my work is how can we look across art, architecture, choreography, music composition, movie making, painting, drama, literature, poetry, and how can we look at the implicit codes of emotional impact in the arts and bring those codes of emotional impact into the...
Well, again, this is Casey Trufo, and I just want to welcome you to day 5 of the Therapist Leadership Conference. And we have Dr. Jeff Zeig in just a moment that's going to be speaking with us. Jeff, we've just got about 5 more minutes as people are joining us on the line that we're just kind of welcoming them.
Okay.
And so you are a master of conferences, so the fact that you honored me by attending this one, I'm just incredibly grateful.
You honor us by speaking at ours.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you. And I have my flyer here for the Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference, and I want to make sure that partway through, perhaps about halfway through, we talk a little bit about this. Would you be okay with that?
Oh, 100%. Thank you so much for doing that.
Okay. No, it's by far the best conference on the entire planet, and in fact, Time Magazine says it's the largest gathering ever devoted to the practice of psychotherapy, but it's more than that. It's the quality of the speakers, and I've been attending since I was a student, and just absolutely every year love them and know more and learn more. And from the bottom of my heart, Jeff, I want to thank you for putting this on every so many years. You usually do it 5, but this time it's 4?
Yeah, it was a quirk. We couldn't find the proper venue in 2010 for the week that we wanted, and there's only a few cities in the United States where you can hold the conference. So Anaheim made us a deal for bringing the conference in 2009, and that's just how it happened. We really wanted to do it in 2010, but Orlando and New Orleans, Las Vegas, the venues that we wanted just weren't available.
Really? Mm-hmm. I'm very lucky because Anaheim is about 4 miles from where we are.
Uh-huh.
So we're really looking forward to it.
Great. You're registered.
Are you kidding? I have everybody I know registering.
Oh, fantastic.
So, and again, there are some special discounts if you register at certain times. I don't know if we still have time for any of those.
Oh, yeah. The next early registration deadline is June 15th. Actually, we've extended it from May 31st to June 15th, and we can even provide your listeners with a special discount code that would give them even a nicer discount.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I will look forward to that, and I'm sure lots of people will. Whenever I speak about conferences, Jeff, I start with the Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference. There's no other conference like it. And again, at about the half-hour mark, that's usually when most people are on the line.
Okay.
And so I want to make sure that we mention it then.
Sure.
Great. And I'm just curious, when you travel 18 days out of the country, how does that impact you physically? I'm just curious.
Well, I've been doing it for so long that I don't know any other way. So, of course, you have to spend time resting, and the older that you get, the more recovery time that you need. But I'm leaving I'm leaving on May 10th, and I'll be 18 days in Europe. So
wow.
I was 18 days in Asia. I'm here until May 10th, and then 18 days with the couples conference in between, we'll be in Ireland. I just picked something out of the hat to utilize. She was available, and so I utilized her, but I to tell you the truth, in those moments, if there was a Coca-Cola can, I would have found a way to utilize that, or a piece of paper, I would have found a way to utililize that. And, are you okay? Are you still with me?
Yes, they're saying your voice is still a little staticky or a little quiet.
Okay, well, I'll try to speak up, too.
Okay, thank you.
And you keep me on track and make sure that I'm, giving you the vocal quality that you need.
Thank you.
Yeah. So now you'll have to remind me and cue me back to where we were. So it's a matter of utilization.
Yes.
Utilization is a doctrine that says whatever exists in the situation, you utilize. And if Freud added, 13 cases to the psychotherapy literature, and Milton Erickson added some 400 cases to the psycholiterature. So there's nobody in history who's had as many new cases to psychotherapy as Milton Erickson had. And the pivot, the fulcrum for all of those cases is utilization. So you could utilize the person's metaphor, you could utilize people who happen to be in the room, you could utilize objects that exist, you can utilize the person's style, you can utilize the person's speed, you could utilize the therapist's handicap. So whatever Erickson had at his disposal, he utilized. And so utilization is a foundational concept in Ericksonian therapy. In one of the most simplest and most famous cases is a sort of one-liner that Erickson did with a schizophrenic patient who knew that he was Jesus Christ. And so the patient was angrily and anxiously empowering himself in the hospital, where he's disempowered, by saying to everyone that he's Jesus Christ. And he's trying to convert everybody to Christianity, and he's being really annoyed, and no intervention is helping. So they give the patient to Erickson, and Erickson walks over to the man and says, "Sir." "Yes, my son?" "Sir, I understand that you have experience as a carpenter." "Well, yes, my son." "Well, sir, will you help us?" "Of course, my son." "Will you help us down in the woodworking shop?" "Certainly, my son." And then Erickson walks the man down to the woodworking shop, and gets the person involved in doing something that is much more useful. So rather than analyzing why the person is the way they are, it's a matter of utilizing their metaphor. Well, just look into Uncommon Therapy, any of the books about Erickson, and you see this facet. So another thing that I've been trying to actualize in my own practice is a moment-to-moment understanding of utilization, and creating experiences that empower people. So as a very simple example, I have a woman who came to me, and she had left her husband and established a relationship with another man, and now her husband wanted her back, and she was toying with the idea of going back with her husband. And so she came to me for a single session of psychotherapy, and she's sitting there, and she's just expostulating into air, and she's talking about all of the different characteristics, and what did this mean, and what did that behavior mean in this one, and what did this behavior mean in that one. And I'm getting a little lonely at this moment, because really she's just using me as a sounding board to understand her own thinking. So I pick up a tissue, which is the only thing I happen to have available, and I start shredding the tissue into very small pieces. And then I put them on a little hassock that was in between us, and I start moving around the different pieces and sorting through them. And finally, this gets her attention, and she says, "What are you doing?" And I say, "Well, I'm doing an act of divination." And she looks at me curiously, because she doesn't know what I mean. And I say, "Well, yeah, I'm, you know, looking through these pieces of paper, and I'm looking for signs." And suddenly she breaks into a peal of laughter. And she understands what it is that she had been doing. And rather than saying to her, confronting her in a verbal way with what it was that she was doing and how she was creating an obsessive loop that would never get her to solve a problem needed to be solved with her heart, I actualized things into a little symbolic drama, and I allowed her to empower herself into the ambiguity of that symbolic drama. And so this becomes more and more of what I try to do in psychotherapy, create these little experiential moments that empower simple ideas.
Now, is that what you mean by individualized treatment?
Individualized treatment. When Erickson was 75, Margaret Mead wrote a tribute. They both were born in 1901, and they started collaborating with each other, I think, when they were each about 36 or 37. And then Margaret Mead wrote a tribute and said one of the distinguishing characteristics of Milton Erickson was that he individualized the treatment for each patient. And he really did. So rather than using a template, rather than using a script, it was a focal point of Erickson to tailor the therapy to the uniqueness of the individual. But psychotherapy for person A is not psychotherapy for person B. Now, this adds to the power. If you want to empower psychotherapy, one way is to use hypnosis, one way might be using multiple level communication, one way might be using experiential techniques, one way may be to individualize, speak the person's experiential language, as one way of empowering the moment. This was so important to Erickson that in 1978, when I had organized the first Congress, I asked him to write something that I could put on the inside of the brochure. And he wrote that psychotherapy is cursed by making the patient fit the crusty in bed of a hypothetical theory of human behavior, when psychotherapy should be individualized to the uniqueness of the person. So that was not the exact quote, but it was pretty close. So that was so important to Erickson, tailoring, individualizing, inventing a new therapy for each patient. What you sacrifice there is research, because you can't have an empirically validated protocol and you can't have an empirically validated therapy when the therapist is working so uniquely to individualize. But for therapists, if you want an antidote to burnout and you want to really reach into the creative spirit that probably impelled you to become a therapist in the first place, you don't want to be a technician and just read somebody else's script. You really want to invent yourself and help somebody else invent themselves at the moment. So this issue of individualizing, yes, that tends to be very important.
I love that utilization example with the tissue.
Yeah.
I saw somebody do that once. She put a tissue on her head.
Right. Yeah, it's another example that just comes to mind. I'm dealing with this woman. She's got an MBA. She's brilliant and much more intellectually powerful than I am. And she's working in a difficult situation for two professionals who are really taking advantage of her good grace. And she doesn't realize how she is allowing herself to be exploited. And so as I'm sitting with her, I pick up the paperweight on my desk and I put it on her lap. And she takes it. And then I take a pen and I hand it to her, and she's holding on to the pen. And then I take a book and she's holding on to that too, and she continues to talk about how she's being exploited in her situation without really fully recognizing what it is that she's saying. Finally, I take off my shoe and I put my shoe in her lap. And she's sitting there with all of these odd objects looking at me quizzically. And finally, she gets it.
That's great.
And she pushes all of these things back to me. And I say to her, metaphorically, yeah, if a woman is walking down the street and somebody's offering her a gift and she doesn't want it, is she impelled to take it? Is she compelled to take it? And she looks at me and says, no. And I say, well, if a woman is walking down the street and somebody gives her a bag of shit,
let's give it back.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And then we did other work. For example, I remember sculpting for her a new ego state. And we sculpted the ego state of Athena. And Athena was a warrior, but not an imperialist. And we sculpted the state where Athena would have her shield and her helmet and her spear. And Athena was a protector of boundaries. So Athena didn't try to go over boundaries and take anybody else's territory, but Athena wasn't going to allow anyone to encroach upon them. So now if I would have talked with this woman, I said, well, you need to establish adequate boundaries, I would have been 100% right. But I don't know that it would have meant anything to her on an experiential level. Now when I stood up and I'm going through this drama of creating Athena and having her take on the characteristics of Athena, then suddenly the idea of boundaries could be something that was coming from her in an experiential way rather than a concept that I was trying to explain to her didactically. Well, in some level, she knew to create boundaries, but she didn't know how to realize what it was that she knew.
And because she was so bright, you know, you're able to skip around.
Yes, that helped.
The cognitive part.
Well, yeah. She was, you know, a pretty intact person. Wasn't having major psychological issues or major personality distortions. So it was, an easier person to work with and really coming to me with a circumscribed problem.
Is it okay if I interrupt you for just a second to talk about the Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference?
Yeah, that would be really wonderful.
Great. If you have never attended an Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference, then you absolutely have to. It's December 9th through the 13th, 2009, Wednesday through Sunday. It's in Anaheim, California. It's basically right across the street from Disneyland. And the most amazing speakers are going to be there. There'll be pre-conference presentations with Daniel Amen, Andrew Weil. We're going to be having faculty like you wouldn't believe. I mean, like you said, Chloe Madonis and Francine Shapiro, Judith Beck, Albert Bandura, Eugene Genblin, focusing guy. I think of him as the focusing guy. William Glasser, the Gottmans, James Masterson, Sal Mnuchin, Martin Seligman, just an amazing group of people. And these are the people, especially we have a lot of students on the line too, and I just want to share with you that I went to my first Evolution of Psychotherapy conference as a student, and it was the most amazing experience. So if you're interested, take advantage of some of the discounts that we've got going on now, www.evolutionofpsychotherapy.com. And you said that you would maybe give us some information about possibly our attendees might be able to get a little bit of discount.
Yes. Well, as long as let's see, if the attendees put in the code Milton, capital M-I-L-T-O-N, I think that that would be a discount code that they could take advantage of, and it would be especially good to take advantage of before the June 15th deadline. Also, everyone who registers prior to July 31st for the hotel will get a discount rate at the hotel, and also there are probably 100 different perks that are giveaways that we're going to be providing to people who register for their hotel by July 31st. And the conference, let me say just something about the history of the conference, which was an inspiration to me. In 1985, I organized the first Evolution of Psychotherapy conference. And that was Bruno Bettelheim and Carl Rogers, Virginia Satir, Rollo May, R.D. Lang, Carl Whitaker, Murray Bowen, Jay Haley. Virginia Satir, if I didn't say her. This was really Woodstock for psychotherapy.
It was.
And so we had 7,200 people who came to Phoenix, and the conference was sold out at Labor Day. That's 3 months in advance. You couldn't get a ticket to that conference because we had just maxed out on our capabilities. We could only house 7,200 people. Time Magazine came. Daniel Goleman was the person who came out from the New York Times.
Wow.
And he was working as a behavioral science writer of the New York Times, so he did the articles on the conference for the New York Times. The Los Angeles Times was there. And Time Magazine had a one-page article on the Evolution Conference. So it was a moment of consilience. It was a moment where we brought together the leading exponents from different areas of psychotherapy and gave them an opportunity to be on stage together and for some of them to meet together for the first time. So we had in my suite, prior to the conference, we had the faculty meeting. And I watched as then 78-year-old Joseph Volpe walked over to then 83-year-old Carl Rogers. And they said to each other, well, we've never met before. And they said, well, I guess we haven't. And so that gives you some idea of where psychotherapy was in 1985.
Wow.
That these leading exponents of the humanistic school and the behavioral school had never met before. So when I hatched the idea of the Evolution Conference, I had no idea that it would be as successful as it turned out to be, and certainly I had no idea that I could bring together that kind of faculty. I had organized my first Erickson Congress in 1980, so I had some years of conference organizing experience, and the idea of the Evolution Conference, well, it just seemed like a good idea at the time, and when I wrote to the faculty and explained to them the idea, they were completely enthusiastic, and or practically every single person who I invited, I think there was one exception. I don't think Eric Erickson was available to come at that time, but everybody who I invited came to the conference, and it was a spectacular event. And then when we reheld the conference in 2000, we held it every 5 years, we did it. Even in 1994, we had 6,000 people come to Hamburg, Germany for the European Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference. But when we held the conference in 2005, we had 8,600 people come from 40 different countries. So it's an incredible opportunity for, one, showing some respect and appreciation for the contributors who have really shaped the face of 21st century and 20th century psychotherapy, but an incredible opportunity for education and fellowship, and it's just a spectacular event in 2005. I just didn't want the conference to end. I liked it so much. It was just so pretty, and everybody was so enthusiastic, and the spirit of the meeting was transcendent.
And I think I went to everything that everything I could possibly go to. And Albert Ellis, I must have seen him. If he spoke, I was a groupie there. I mean, it was just amazing. And now I'm so glad that I did.
Yeah, you know? Al was just wonderful. And he was present at every one of the conferences up to 2005. In 2005, impaired as he was physically at the time, challenged as he was physically, he came with two nurses and his wife, and he was going to be there. So that was the last major conference at which he spoke.
But, I mean, I got to see Carl Whitaker at one before. And so if you are a student or if you're a seasoned clinician, make sure you attend the Evolution of Psychotherapy conference again, www.evolutionofpsychotherapy.com. And thank you very much for that offer of that discount code in all caps, Milton.
No, I think it's CAP, Big Cap M.
Cap M.
But it's case sensitive, so you might have to tease
Okay, well, try it out, you guys, because it will give you some discount there, and especially you want to check out getting your hotel room before the July 31st as well. And then also I just want to mention for those that got on late, the Couples Conference in San Diego, May 1st through the 3rd, is another conference that you organize, and that's at www.couplesconference.com. And I know we've had Ellen Bader, Chloe Madonis, I think some of the other speakers that you're going to have at that conference, we've also had this week on our conference. And so if you want more and you want to see them in person, then please go visit that. It's in San Diego, May 1st through the 3rd at couplesconference.com. And I really appreciate you allowing me to share this information because my experience as a clinician has been so enriched. If I could pick one thing, it's been this conference. And I will, the Evolution of Psychotherapy conference, and I'll share, if I may, why that is. A lot of times the theorists will write books, or these major thought leaders will write books, and then by the time they get published and by the time they get into the curriculum of the schools, they often have done more research, done more reflection, and changed and moved on, and yet the written knowledge sometimes is behind them. And so the opportunity to see Virginia Satir at the time and to learn how she had come beyond the books that she had written and with some of the others, that was the powerful education. And just to get the personal sense of the person, just lovely. So thank you for doing that for us.
Sure. Okay, so where do we go to next? Are there questions from some of the listeners?
One of them says, which hotel is the conference at? It's going to be at the Anaheim Convention Center, and the hotels are the Hilton and the Marriott in Anaheim. Is that right, Jeff?
That's right. And if you go to the evolutionofpsychotherapy.com website, you see the information about the two conference hotels. So those are venues where the meetings will take place in addition to the conference center, which is right across the street. It's
exactly
easy campus.
And there is a question here. It says, in your handout, you have something called orienting toward. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Ericksonian therapy, one of the ways of increasing impact has been to use indirection. And indirection has a little bit of a pejorative connotation. So, for example, if somebody is if you're asking a patient in hypnosis to do an arm levitation, you can say to the patient, lift your hand and arm. Now, if the patient just lifts his hands and arm in response to that suggestion, well, we don't know if that's a hypnotic response or not, because in order to really qualify as a hypnotic response, it has to happen to some degree dissociatively, automatically. So in order to get that effect, we may use a series of indirect techniques, and there's a grammar and a language of different indirect techniques. Like one would be using a presupposition. I don't know when your hand can begin to lift up toward your face now, or using an embedded command, you can lift your hand, or using what we would call an implied causative, when you take a deep breath and inhale, then you can lift your hand. So there's a whole technology of grammar of how to use indirect suggestions. And at one time I taught these, and I asked people to memorize these different language forms so that they could add them into the structure of an induction and empower the induction. The induction would look a little bit like Matryoshka doll, the Russian doll, like there would be a structure within a structure within a structure, and the multiple level nature of that is in itself empowering. The idea of orienting towards would be more like utilization. Orienting towards would be a state. And rather than the therapist thinking left hemisphere, okay, now I'm going to use presuppositions, the therapist would get into this state of orienting toward. For example, Shakespeare says, when through the sessions of sweet silent thought, I summon up this remembrance of things past, I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought, and with old woes new wail my dear times waste. So if Shakespeare is saying that, he's orienting us towards an emotion. He's not saying, here's what depression could be like, but he's orienting us towards. If Monet puts some vague lines on a canvas, he orients us towards seeing water lilies. So orienting towards is a state that we assume when we want to elicit rather than inform. If you're teaching somebody physics, you inform. Here's the formula. If you're teaching somebody geometry, you inform. Here's the formula. But when you want people to access states, you need to orient toward. You can't say to somebody, be happy. You can't say to someone, be spontaneous. But you can create a series of impressions that empower the person to move into that state. So orienting toward is one of a number of therapist substates. And I know that's a little bit of a strange concept to think about, but if you think about a psychoanalyst, to be a psychoanalyst, you have to access a series of substates, and that may not maybe being very formal and having patients come in one door but leave through another door, only shaking hands when the person says comes in and shaking hands when they say goodbye. So there's a series of implicit codes about the state that you take on. If you're going to be a cognitive therapist, there's a series of states that you take on. If you're going to be a traditional hypnotist, you might be dynamic, imposing, authoritarian. These are states that you take on. If you're going to be an Ericksonian therapist, you might get into the state of utilization. You might get into the state of orienting toward. You might get into the state of tailoring. You might get into the state of being experiential. And these are a series of substates that would define getting into an Ericksonian posture. So more and more in my teaching, it's teaching people to move into a posture rather than teaching people techniques that they will use. And that if you get into this posture, you generate technique. Technique comes by virtue of the therapist going into the first trance. The first trance could be utilization or tailoring. Now, orienting towards, that doesn't sound like it would be a state, but is curiosity a state? Is motivation a state? Is learning a state? Well, we know when we're in a learning mode, and we know when we're in a curious mode, we know when we're in love, we feel that. We can't really define what it is to be in love. And for that matter, if you want somebody to be in love with you, you can't say, by the way, would you just love me?
Were it only that easy.
Right. So you have to establish a series of conditions by being romantic and being interested and sorting for similarities and smiling a lot and using a lot of open behavior. And then if you do these things, you are orienting the other person to be in love with you. And if the person decides to play with the toys that you put on their psychosocial physiological stage, they respond. But we're all experts at orienting toward, except that somehow in psychotherapy we seem to be limiting ourselves to using concrete and very clear and logically understandable words rather than doing the things that poets use. And poets know that if you want to change someone's state, then you're going to use allusions and metaphors and strange constructions. And so I study what these people do and how the artists of all kinds, including architects, how they orient us toward interior decorators, how they orient us toward, and that there are specific codes that can be used and that we can apply these codes to the moments that we want to have impact in psychotherapy. If you have a regressed patient and you need to teach them about the difference between an assertive, a passive, aggressive behavior, then psychoeducation is great. But if you're helping somebody to move into a state of being more loving or more conciliant or more sensitive or more kind, we need a technology for how to help people to move into states. And orienting towards is, although it sounds strange, it's completely endemic to human behavior. If you looked at all of the things that you do to orient people in your life towards a response, you would realize that they clearly outweigh the number of times that you use a direct verbal suggestion to get a response.
Absolutely. We have a question on the webcast, Jeff. It says, where can I learn more about how to access states and substates?
Well, if you go to any of the people, the primary people who teach about Ericksonian therapy, in one way or another, they're going to be talking about that. So Rossi, Langton, Gilligan, O'Hanlon, these people...
You?
Yes, are people who will teach about this. The specifics of this state's model, this is more a territory that I've carved out. And so this is what is impelling me in my most recent writing and my most recent explorations. So the state's model, that's something that I talk about more. But truthfully, even if you went to the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis and went to what I would consider a more traditional model of learning hypnosis, you still learn things there about changing states. In 1972, I think, I went to my first meeting at the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis, and I saw a dentist, Kay Thompson, who later became a mentor of mine, and she was working with a physician, and she did an arm levitation, anesthetized his hand by just using concepts that created an anesthesia, put a surgical needle through a fold of skin with no pain, and then said, how many drops of blood do you want to bleed when I remove this needle? And he specified the number of drops to bleed. I saw a physician, Franz Baumann, who is very famous in San Francisco, a pediatrician, and he was talking with a young boy who had asthma, and then suggested hypnotically that the boy was in a field of hay, and then held a microphone up to the boy's chest, and you could hear the rails of asthma. So these people knew that you could use communication to change physiology, that you could speak to the physiology, and that people could change their states and change their physiology. So when I started to understand that, it intrigued me, and I really wanted to learn more. And so I learned a lot of things about traditional hypnosis, and then eventually, shortly after that, got to spend time with Milton Erickson. And intermittently, between 73 and 78, I traveled frequently to Phoenix to learn from him. And then in 78, when I moved to Phoenix, effectively, I took over Erickson's practice. He didn't even have a student in Phoenix, and he started referring patients to me. I quit my job at the hospital and went into private practice and have been in private practice ever since. But it was that mentality of helping people by moving into states. So I can't say that there's something cogent as a model where you can read about it yet, but certainly at my workshops and lectures, these are the topics that interest me.
And they can find out more about that at JeffZeig.com, is that right?
No, my JeffZeig.com is more for people who want to organize programs.
Okay, where would be the best place?
JeffZeig.com, you could also find my workshop schedule, and you could see some of the workshops that I'm doing, and this is something that, even if you were able to read about it, it's not adequate. There are some things that you really have to experience.
Experience, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Mostly it's an experiential teaching model.
We had a question. When you're talking about nature and art and that appealing to the senses, we've had a couple presentations on mindfulness. Do you see any intersection between what you're talking about and mindfulness?
Sure. Well, when you're doing mindfulness training, you're putting somebody into another state in which they can examine their problems from a distance. So they can look at their obsessive thoughts from a distance. They can feel their depressive feelings from a distance. They can be in a state of mindfulness. So mindfulness and active imagination and autogenic training and relaxation training, these all, and even self-hypnosis, these all have a common core. The common core is that if you change your attention, if you change the intensity of your experience, if you experience dissociation in some way, that this state in itself can be empowering. And that's a common core with hypnosis. Hypnosis, as I define it, different from other experts, is an interpersonal field. And it is a responsiveness to the implication of communication in addition to the way in which you change your attention, change the intensity of your experience, and dissociate. But that's an important addition. It's how people respond that defines hypnosis, not just the changes in attention, intensity, and dissociation. So mindfulness has an overlap, but it's important, and it's one of many experiential approaches that I might choose to use in my practice.
What is gift wrapping?
Gift wrapping is another way of empowering ideas. So rather than saying information directly, you can gift wrap that information in a metaphor, in an illusion, in a directive, in a story, and so gift wrapping is one additional way of empowering ideas. I can give you an example. It might take a couple of minutes.
Oh, we'd love an example.
Yeah, so I'll give you my favorite Erikson story. 78, I moved to Phoenix, and I got my PhD. I was a marriage family counselor in California in 1973. I got my PhD, and then I got my psychologist license in 1978. And I'm a new psychologist in Arizona. An attorney calls me, and the attorney says that he was referred to be by Milton Erickson, that he was representing a young man, who was charged with murder. A witness to the crime had been hypnotized by a police investigator to refresh that witness's memory. And the attorney believed that the hypnosis was done improperly and contaminated the perspective of the witness. Would I view the videotape of the police investigator's hypnosis and say whether or not it contaminated the witness? I said, well, I'm a new psychologist. I've never testified in court before. I will give you my best opinion. So my credentials were submitted to the court that I was trained by Milton Erickson, world's foremost authority on hypnosis. And my credentials were accepted. And then, because the attorney had called Milton Erickson, Erickson said that he was too old, too ill, calls Ike. So meanwhile, the prosecuting attorney calls Erickson and says, we have this important case. It will be a landmark case. The validity of hypnosis as a forensic tool is being challenged. Will you testify? Erickson said, well, I'm too old, calls Ike. And the attorney said, no, we can't have a student. We need really somebody with a national, international reputation. If you won't testify, will you at least give a deposition? So Erickson said, yeah. So now the sides are so there's Ike for the defense, there's Erickson for the prosecution.
Wow.
So I call Erickson. I say, can I come over and talk with you for a minute? And he says, sure. And so I go over and I say, here's the situation. What are you doing? And he said, well, Jeff, you have a few things to learn, don't you? And I said, absolutely.
That's great.
And then I thought about this and I said, Dr. Erickson, you know, I'm scared about testifying in court. I've never testified in court before. And I'm anxious about it, and can you give me some therapy that will help me? And so Erickson looks at the floor, and suddenly you know that a story is going to emerge and that he's going to gift wrap his therapy within this story. And the story is about a previous case in which he was testifying, child custody case, and he was testifying for the husband because he believed that the husband was the best custodial parent for the children. He had done a psychiatric examination on the wife, the husband, the children. He was prepared to testify for the husband as a custodial parent. And this is a time at which the wife always got custody, custodial custody.
Right.
And so on the day of the, in a pre-conference meeting, he was not given any information about the wife's attorney. So he inferred that she was really going to be difficult and challenging, and she was. So on the day of the court, the woman's attorney comes to Erickson with 13 pages of typewritten questions ready to undermine his professional opinion that the husband should have the custodial rights. And she's very aggressive, and she starts, and she says, Dr. Erickson, you say that you're an expert in psychiatry. Who is your authority? And Erickson says, well, I'm my authority. So as if he would have said Freud or Jung or Eric Byrne or anyone, she would have said, aren't those theories speculative? And she would have started to undermine Erickson's testimony.
Ah.
And so then she continued aggressively. She says, Dr. Erickson, you say that you're an expert in psychiatry. What is psychiatry? And Erickson says, story within a story, I can give you an example. If I were an expert on American history, I would know something about Simon Gertie, also called Dirty Gertie. If anyone, an expert on American history, would know something about Simon Gertie, also called Dirty Gertie. And anyone who is not an expert on American history would not know about Simon Gertie, also called Dirty Gertie. But any expert on American history should know about Simon Gertie, also called Dirty Gertie. Erickson said at that moment he looked up at the judge, and the judge had his hands over his face. He said that the clerk of the court was underneath the table trying to find a pencil, and his attorney, the attorney for his side, could not suppress an uncontrollable grin. The attorney looked up at him and said, no further questions, Dr. Erickson. And the name of the woman attorney?
Yes?
Gertie.
Oh, no.
And Erickson was saying, Dirty Gertie. And Erickson said that the attorney for his side in future cases against Gertie, whenever Gertie got aggressive, always found a way of sneaking in a reference to Simon Gertie, also called Dirty Gertie. Now, Simon Gertie was actually a historical figure. He was a traitor during the American Revolution. And so that was real. And so that was the advice Erickson gave me. Now, suddenly, at that moment, I was cataleptic. Because I had to understand what is it that he was saying to me
right.
in this gift wrap message. And then suddenly, I shifted into first gear. And I thought, oh, yeah, he's saying, okay, Jeff, you can use the techniques that you've learned from me, like using embedded commands. He was saying, Jeff, you can trust your unconscious. Some fact will come to your mind that will make you adequate for dealing with the situation. He was saying to me, you don't need to be intimidated by the situation. But if he would have said, Jeff, you don't need to be intimidated by the situation. You have some fact in your own history. You can use my techniques. I would have written those things down, and I would have forgotten them, and I wouldn't have had a story to tell some 30 years later. But when Erickson took those ideas and he gift-wrapped them within a story, they became experientially alive, and I shifted into second gear. Because now, every time I walk into a courtroom, I have a hallucination. And I hallucinate me and Milton Erickson, and we're sitting in his living room, and we're laughing so hard at the story of Dirty Gertie. And he can't catch his breath because he's laughing so hard, and I'm laughing because he's laughing. And I see the courtroom, but I see it through that hallucination. And I might feel something about being in a courtroom, but I feel it through that hallucination. So when Erickson gift-wrapped that, it was a way of engaging my perceptual system, which, by the way, is not much different than what Monet would do, or Picasso would do, or Robert Frost would do, or Steven Spielberg would do, or Shakespeare would do. So I find that I can understand more about Erickson when I cast him as being an experiential artist. And I think that Erickson, being as well-read and knowledgeable as he was, recognized that the same techniques that Thomas Mann would use in creating a novel were eminently applicable to hypnosis and psychotherapy.
What a lovely story. It reminded me of really good parenting.
Yes, it was really good parenting.
There's one question that's slightly off topic, but I'd love to hear your answer, and that is, how do you feel about the idea of touch in psychotherapy?
Yeah, well, because of today's legal ethical environment, I don't use very much touch in psychotherapy. When I'm doing demonstrations and there's lots of people in the audience, I use much more touch because it's such a primitive and experiential way of reaching people. But when you have an audience there and there's somebody, you know, who's watching you, and you have that protective sense, it's much different. And just a pity now that touch is not something that can be used more, because on an experiential level, how we respond to signals is very important. It's an area that we haven't touched on and probably shouldn't open up at this moment. But if you think about it, if a movie director wants you to think about sex, he just shows you a bed. If he wants you to think about illness, he shows you a hospital, some instrument. And so this is a movie technique called pars per toto, which is using signals to get responses. Now, in the animal kingdom, lizards have to communicate. They communicate with signals. Bees communicate with signals. Dogs communicate with signals. And we communicate with signals, except we don't pay attention to the subcortical ways in which we communicate. And touch is such an important signal to people, and you can communicate so much by touch. But in today's ethical environment, it's pretty hard to justify that, and those things, because they're ambiguous, can be misinterpreted. So in my everyday practice, I tend to stay away from it.
I agree with you. I find that disappointing that we're in that place. Well, a bunch of comments are coming in on the question and answers, just saying, thank you, Dr. Zog. This is so impressive. I learned so much. Thank you so much. I hadn't thought about that states before. Thank you. So we're getting a lot of great comments. And I really want to thank you. I know that you've been traveling, and you're right in the middle of being home finally for a little break, and you actually took time out of your busy schedule to support this conference. And I just really want to thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Yeah.
You really honored us.
Yesterday, I was in Hong Kong.
I know.
Is it true?
I know. We were wondering about your travel schedule on the way back, and we were saying prayers for your pilots and everything.
Well, it was really a pleasure. Wonderful. And I'm glad that you invited me to be a contributor. I'm honored, really.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I hope you will consider doing it again. I won't beg you on this line, but I will be speaking with you.
Yeah.
But thank you very much. And good luck with all of the conferences, and I'll be seeing you there.
Okay. Thank you so much, Kate.
Thank you, Dr. Zog. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.